this concludes the Lord's table, and the basket is in the back for our collection this morning.
Good morning, church. It's good to see you all this morning. You can turn in your Bibles to Luke chapter 7. We're going to continue looking through Luke this morning. We've been going through usually once a week, but a little bit kind of spread out recently, looking through the Gospel of Luke. Noticing some different principles within the gospel relating to discipleship and what discipleship is about and how to strengthen our personal discipleship to Christ, but also to help lead others and evangelize in the community and help others to come to know Christ. And so I really enjoy reading through this gospel in particular and noting the themes to do that. I think it's really helpful, especially because more than some of the other gospels, it dovetails really, really well into Acts. And so Acts is part two of Luke, and so it helps to start talking about the church and the actions that started happening after Jesus went back to heaven and those sorts of things. And so in Luke chapter 7, the theme that I really see kind of stand out the most in the chapter is the idea of faith. And we see that in the very beginning, especially in the first event that we're going to spend most of our time talking about this morning in the first 10 verses with this centurion and the faith that is shown by him. But also in the middle of the chapter, there is this episode with John the Baptist where he sends some of his disciples to Christ. And he's in prison at this point, and he kind of asks, are you the one that we were supposed to be waiting for, or are we supposed to find another one? And there's kind of this implication that maybe John is a little bit questioning and kind of struggling with his faith, like, why am I in prison if this is how things are supposed to be and that sort of thing? And so there's this question of faith that comes from John relating to Jesus. And then at the end of the chapter, there is the woman that comes to him, the sinful woman that comes and anoints his feet, washes Jesus' feet with her tears, and dries it with her hair. And Jesus' last thing that he says in the chapter, and the last thing he says to her in verse 50 is, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. And so there's just this chapter is really all about faith in every area and in all of the stories that we read. But this morning I want us to just look at the first encounter in the first 10 verses and see Jesus' encounter with this man. And there are probably a lot of lessons that we could learn from here, but we're going to try to zero in and look at faith and the results of faith and what in particular about this man's faith is so special and important and needs to be kind of replicated in our lives. So let's just start by reading Luke chapter 7, verses 1 through 10. It says, after he had entered, or after he had finished all his sayings and hearings of the people, he entered Capernaum. And now a centurion had a servant who was sick at the point of death and was very highly valued by him. And when the centurion heard about Jesus, he sent to him the elders of the Jews, asking him to come and to heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they pleaded with him earnestly, saying, he is worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation, and he is the one who has built us our synagogue. And Jesus went with them, and when he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy for you to come under my roof. Therefore I did not presume to come to you, but say the word, and let my servant be healed. For I too am a man set under authority, with soldiers under me, and I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. And when Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him. And turning to the crowds that followed him, he said, I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith. And when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the servant well. One of the things that makes me really excited about this story and being able to study this in relation to faith and in Jesus' interactions with people is that we get to learn what causes Jesus to marvel in this story. We get to learn really what catches Jesus' attention, the actions and the types of things that Jesus would encounter that would cause him to be astonished. And I want to just think about that for a few minutes, this idea of marveling. First of all, marveling, when you read through the Gospels, is actually a pretty common occurrence. There are a lot of people that marvel in the Gospels. If you read through any of the Gospels, you'll see a lot of different people in awe and astounded and just kind of blown away by the things that are happening. And almost every time it'll be people in their interaction with Jesus that are in awe or astounded or marveling at him, whether it's they hear his teaching and they're amazed at the authority that he's teaching with and marveling at that, or they see the miracles and the great works that he's performing and they're really amazed and blown away and marveling at that. But only two times in the Gospels does it say that Jesus marveled. This event becomes very unique because of that. It becomes very unique among the other moments of amazement in the Gospel. And I think it's really fascinating to think of Jesus marveling. Really, I'm surprised that there are two times that Jesus marvels. It surprises me that there's even one time that Jesus marvels, because think about who we're talking about here. We're talking about Jesus, who is God. He is eternal and forever and always. He's seen everything probably multiple times. He's been there from the very beginning. He made all things. Typically, whenever you get older, the older that you are, and I don't have as much experience with this, but I've seen and heard from people that the older that you are, the less you marvel at things, the less amazed you are with things, because you've seen it before, right? Or something similar to that thing before. And so the more experience you gain, the more that you start to see, the less things are surprising to you. And that's not always true. There are still surprises that you have in your life, but the more experience you have under your belt, the less you become amazed at things like you did whenever you were a child or really young. Like my son right now is almost 1 year old. He'll be 1 year in a few days. And he is amazed at almost everything. He's still amazed whenever our dog jumps up to grab a treat. He just loves that. And it makes his day. And it's so incredible to see that. But if, like, you know, the Borings came to our house and we showed them, like, look, Toast really likes his treats. Well, that's nice, but like, it's not amazing, right? It's not incredible, because you've seen a dog enjoy treats before, but Ray is still, that's new for him. But Jesus is marveling here. He knows everything. He's seen everything. He's experienced everything, but yet he still marvels whenever he sees the centurion's actions and the things that he's doing here. And we'll talk about, I think, why he's marveling specifically about this event in just a few minutes. But I think it's really, really helpful, because we can learn a lot about a person by what they marvel at and by what really astonishes them, what really amazes them or impresses them. You learn a lot about the character of a person whenever you see that. I've noticed that just in being married. TJ and I have almost been married for 2 years, and I learned a lot about her, way more about her in the last 2 years than I did anything previously, because I see more and more the things that amaze her and the things that she marvels at. And granted, she marvels at a lot more things than I do. She's a lot more excitable than I am in different things. But I learn more about her because of the things that impress her and the things that she really enjoys to kind of see in that way. And so we can learn about people based on what impresses them, what causes their jaw to drop, in a sense, and be amazed at something. And so in this section, we see what really impresses Jesus. And it's not the things that typically we marvel at or we're impressed with. Usually whenever someone is marveling or impressed with something, we marvel at things like waterfalls or at really amazing sports plays or really fantastic musical performances. Or for me, a perfectly cooked strawberry cake. Like that's my favorite thing, my favorite dessert of all time whenever TJ makes that. But those are the kind of things that cause us to marvel, really kind of insignificant sorts of things in the grand scheme of life and existence. But for Jesus, the thing that makes him marvel is in verse 9 of Luke chapter 7. He turns around and he says to the crowd, "I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith." This particular type of faith that he sees in the centurion that wasn't really anywhere else that he had seen in Israel among the people of God, this type of faith that the centurion demonstrates is what causes Jesus to be really, really amazed. That's what causes Jesus' jaw to drop. And interestingly enough, I said there were only two times that Jesus marvels in the Gospels. There's one here at the really great example of faith. The other time that's recorded when Jesus marvels is in Mark chapter 6, whenever he goes to his hometown of Nazareth and he's trying to show them who he is and quoting from Isaiah. And we studied that in the Gospel of Luke a few weeks ago. And you remember the people of Nazareth reject him. They had their preconceived ideas about him. They don't want to listen to him. They don't really think that he is who he says he is. And the text in Mark chapter 6 says he marveled at their unbelief. And so both times that Jesus is found in awe or just marveling is either at the extreme example of great faith or the extreme example of disbelief and the lack of faith. And I think that's really telling about what Jesus sees and what Jesus really thinks about and what he's looking at. Oftentimes what Jesus is looking at when he's evaluating people is not what we look at when we evaluate people. We didn't get to read this, but turn back to Luke chapter 5. Whenever we were going through Luke chapter 5, we didn't read this story. But I'm reminded of this, and this is a good example to show what the focus of Jesus is on people based on their actions. In Luke 5 and verse 17 and following, we have the account of the paralytic that comes to Jesus. And this is told in other Gospels, like in Mark chapter 2 and various other places. But you remember the story of the guy who's paralyzed, and so he can't get to Jesus, so his friends carry him to Jesus. And he's got his four friends that bring him to the house that Jesus is in. But when they get there, it's really full. They can't get close to Jesus. They can't bring their friend there. But they really persevere, and so they get up on the roof and let their friend down through the roof of the house. And so they go to, like, extreme odds to be able to let their friend have this encounter with Jesus so he can be healed. And in Luke chapter 5 and verse 20, Jesus' first thing that he says to him is, or the first thing the text says is, when he saw their faith, he said, man, your sins are forgiven you. But Jesus is looking at their faith, and he realizes their faith as a result of their actions. And so that's kind of the focus of what Jesus is doing here. And that tells me that when Jesus is observing our lives, the things that he's looking for, one of the big things that he looks for in our life is the demonstration of faith that we have towards him and what that causes us to do in our practical lives and our relationship with him and our dealings with other people. But back in Luke chapter 7, what is it specifically about this man's faith that impresses Jesus? Because there were already instances in the Gospel of Luke where Jesus has encountered people that had faith in him, that trusted in him. Like, we just saw one in Luke chapter 5, but he doesn't marvel in Luke chapter 5. At least the text doesn't say that he marvels in Luke 5. What makes him really marvel about this guy's faith? What's so impressive and different and stands out about him? Before we get there, because that's where we're going, I want to just kind of observe some different things about this man. Like, what's his character? What is this centurion like? What type of person is he? And what can we see about him from the other examples or details given to us in this story? One of the first qualities that I see about the centurion is that he is a man of kindness. He's an extremely kind man. And you think about this. What is a centurion? Like, what is a Roman centurion? He's a man that's in the Roman government. I had always heard, but actually in getting ready for this lesson, I just wanted to check because I'd heard it a lot, but I don't think I've ever checked. I'd always heard that a Roman centurion was over 100 soldiers. I actually found some things that said they were only over 80 soldiers, which doesn't make sense to me. It's kind of weird. They were over 100 men, but only 80 of them were soldiers typically. And so I don't know if that makes a big difference, but he's still over a lot of men. So he has a lot of authority, a lot of pull in the government and in the place that he had been stationed here in Capernaum. And so he's really kind of a great man in the things that he does. He's a commander and an officer. And if you look at the other details in this story, we can kind of start to understand that he's probably pretty well off, maybe rich. He has different slaves and servants that indicate his wealth and some other things we'll talk about that might indicate his wealth. Yet, the text says when one particular slave becomes sick, he is very concerned with that man and really highly values that man. And perhaps just thinking about what he could have done, perhaps it would have been easier to just let the guy be sick and die and get another servant. Start to think that, you know, I've got other things to take care of. I'm a centurion. I've got other responsibilities. I don't have time to deal with your sickness and try to help you get over it, you know, fend for yourself. Or maybe even kind of trying to protect his own character and his own prestige and thinking, like, it would be kind of degrading and dishonorable for me to go and seek the help of a Jewish guy. Like, why am I going to go seek out the help of Jesus? He's just a Jew. You know, I'm a Roman and I'm in control and that sort of thing, and so I don't need to lower myself to be able to do that. But none of those things are obstacles for this guy because he really cares and wants to demonstrate kindness toward his servant and help him and sacrifice in whatever way. And so we learn about this man's character based on how he treats his servant. It really shows you a lot about a person by how they treat people who are lower than them or lesser than them. I've heard sometimes, I think Scott has mentioned the example of some of the strategies that bosses will sometimes have in hiring an employee, that when they want to hire an employee, they'll take them out to, like, maybe a fancy dinner or something like that and just try to witness and see how that person treats the waitress or the waiter, how they respond to them, how kind they are, how they actually talk to them, and what they think about them. And that shows a lot about the character of a person. And so you can see that this man's character, the Roman centurion, is really honorable, really kind, really caring, and compassionate towards people based on how he treats his servant here and what he wants to do for his servant. Another thing that I see about his character, so there's kindness. I also see faith, and I know that's the big thing that we're talking about here. We'll talk more specifically in detail later on about a specific type of faith, but even before he demonstrates the kind of faith that says that causes Jesus to marvel, I think he demonstrates another kind of faith, and I was trying to think of how to word this. I don't really want to say an ordinary faith, but that's the best way that I could think of it. He has this ordinary kind of faith that he shows first before he gets the really amazing faith that wasn't seen anywhere else in all of Israel. And so he has this ordinary faith that leads him to trust that Jesus can do the things that he's heard people say he can do, that people have seen. And you see that in the text in verse 3. It says, when the centurion heard about Jesus, he sends the elders of the Jews to ask to come and heal his servant. So I get kind of the picture that maybe there are these messengers or people or soldiers or people that are under the centurion that are coming to him and telling him about how Jesus has healed the paralyzed guy, how Jesus has cast out demons, how Jesus has healed the people who are sick. And the centurion sees, well, he's done it before. He could do it again. He can come and do the same thing for me. He can replicate what he's done in the lives of other people and do that for me. And that's a faith to have. I get the idea the centurion has never personally met Jesus or actually maybe even witnessed with his own eyes what Jesus had done, but he's taking what the people are telling him and letting that develop a trust in Jesus for himself. And we're really in the same position as him in that way. None of us have actually seen Jesus. None of us have actually witnessed the great miracles that Jesus has performed, but we have heard from eyewitnesses and people that have seen it and read about that, and so we're in the same kind of position to do exactly what he did, either to disregard it or to have faith in it and trust that Jesus is able to do exactly what he did for other people in my life as well. And so he demonstrates that kind of faith, a faith in what other people had seen. And so he has that kind of as a starting point for his relationship and interaction with Jesus. I also see a character quality in this man of great generosity. He's an extremely generous man in the things that he does and how he treats people. And there are a couple of things that are peculiar in this story that kind of point to that. There are a few things that are peculiar about the people that this man sends to Jesus on his behalf in both instances when he sends people to them. In the first part in verse 3, he sends the Jewish elders to go in his place to go and speak with Jesus and to appeal to Jesus that he would come and heal his servant. And one of the things that's strange about that is that's not who you would expect a Roman centurion to send. The Jews oftentimes didn't really care very highly for the Romans. They didn't really like them. They kind of looked down on them. And they felt that way because, I mean, Rome was kind of in charge. Rome was controlling them and in control of their kingdom and their life. And that sort of thing. But he sends these Jews, and they say something about him that you would not expect a normal Jew to say about your average, everyday Roman. Whenever they get to Jesus, in verse 4, they say, he is worthy to have you do this for him. He's a good guy. He deserves this. Which is really amazing to me. It makes me start to think, wow. Like, what did this guy do that changed the entire cultural bias around how Jews feel about Romans to make these Jews feel that way about this man? That he is a good guy that deserves this for you. And the one thing that they mention as proof of this Roman centurion being a good man and somebody that's worthy of this is his generosity. They say he loves our nation in verse 5. And anyone can say that. You can say, I love you, I love your nation, I'm all about you, and stuff like that. But the centurion puts his generosity where his mouth is. And he is the one that built our synagogue for us. That wasn't something that would have been an expectation for the centurion to do. That's not something that he would have had to do going to Capernaum. But he sacrificed and put in his resources to be able to do this great kindness for the Jews in Capernaum. He was very generous in how he treated them and how he thought about them. And so we see that kindness that we talked about demonstrated again in his generosity, not just for those that are in his household, but also for the people in the community and the people that are around him. So he's a really moral, upstanding guy in the things that he does. Another thing that I see about him, so we've got he's a kind man, he's a man of faith, or at least that ordinary kind of faith so far. He's a man of great generosity. He's also a man of great humility. And again, you can see that demonstrated in a couple of different ways in this story. First, I think by Jesus send, or by who he sends to speak to Jesus for him. We've already seen that those are the Jewish elders, but you think of, if you're a centurion and you're a guy of power and authority and prestige, and you've got all these different men at your disposal, and one of your servants that you highly value becomes sick, and there's an opportunity for you to get someone to come here and to heal your servant, who are you sending to go and influence or persuade that person to come? I think maybe I might send maybe some of my soldiers, maybe some of the tallest and the strongest and the most aggressive looking to push the envelope a little bit and make sure that he comes to do that. But that's not what the centurion does. He doesn't send his soldiers. He doesn't send his authority. He doesn't even go himself. He humbly sends these Jewish elders in his place. And the second place, the second way that I see humility is what he starts to do and who he sends when Jesus actually starts walking in his direction. I get the idea and the picture in this story that like the elders show up to Jesus and they explain the situation and Jesus agrees verbally, verbally commits, says, I'll go, and he starts kind of following along. And then maybe some of the elders or some of the other people run ahead and tell the centurion, hey, Jesus is on his way. He's getting close. He's almost here. And so the text says when he got close to the house, the centurion sends out his friends. Again, not some of his soldiers, but some of his friends to come out. And what they say to him is the centurion tells Jesus, I am not worthy for you to come under my roof, in verse 6. I don't have any archaeological evidence to back this up, but just kind of track with me for a second on like what I'm thinking about, how I'm visualizing this. Capernaum wasn't a particularly big town. It wasn't a metropolis by any means. It was just kind of a small town from what we know and understand about it. And so I think that would most likely lead to the implication that this centurion is probably one of the more important individuals of society in Capernaum. He's probably one of the guys of the most influence and most prestige and kind of highest ranking in the town of Capernaum. Maybe there were some people over him, but he was pretty high up on the ladder as far as authority and who you need to listen to in the city of Capernaum. And so I'm trying to imagine what his house looked like. Like what kind of house did he have? In comparison with all the other houses in Capernaum, we've already seen this is a guy that has authority over a lot of men. He's probably a wealthy man because he's at least able to contribute some of his goods to build a synagogue for the people. He has multiple servants. I'm thinking that this guy probably has one of the nicest houses in town. That is one of the nicest, most furnished, well-pleasing to the eye kind of places that you can live in Capernaum. But whenever Jesus is coming to his house, he says, I'm not even worthy for you to come inside of my house. Not worthy for you to come under my roof. And really what he says in verse 7, he goes on to say, I'm not even really worthy to speak to you face to face. I didn't even presume to come to you. I sent other people to go and talk to you because I'm not worthy to speak to you in person. And so I think he demonstrates really, really great humility whenever he's coming to Jesus. He doesn't let any of his own personal accomplishments or what other people might think of him blind him to the fact that Jesus is so much greater than what he is. And I think that's really important and an integral part of his faith that he demonstrates here. And so he has kindness, he has generosity, he has humility, and even that kind of beginning stage of faith here. And I think all of those things, all those qualities are really connected to this man's faith. And that's something that we learn about faith as it relates to what it accomplishes in our lives, that faith is really this action type of term that influences how we treat people, how we think about ourselves, how we think about God, and it morphs and changes our lives. And that's what we can clearly see, I think, from this centurion, that he is such a good man, I think, as a result of some of the faith that he demonstrates here. But I think, in particular, This moment where Jesus marvels and the timing of Jesus' appraisal for his faith is really important because I think he starts to demonstrate a greater kind of faith than just the original trusting in what other people have told him and what other people have seen. And so the timing of when Jesus is in awe or marveling at him is really important. The moment when Jesus marvels is not whenever he demonstrates great generosity or when he demonstrates great humility. But it comes at the moment when he says in verse 7 and following, basically, don't bother yourself any further. I know that you can just speak the word and it'll happen. What I think is so great about this is not only does the man have faith in what he has heard other people have seen, But he has faith and believes that Jesus can do something that no one has seen. And so in that way, if you read the other Gospels and Luke up to this point, there's no indication from what I can tell that Jesus has done any miracle long distance yet. All of the miracles that Jesus has done, he's been right there. He's either spoken in the same room or touched the person or those sorts of things. But there's no evidence that he's actually been at a different place and accomplished a miracle from great distance. But the centurion believes that he is able to do that. He's able to accomplish that miracle. And so he says, I believe you can do this thing far away. If you just say the words, it'll happen. Someone once called this faith, and I don't remember where I heard this phrase before, but someone teaching through Luke 7 once called this kind of faith a pioneer faith. And I really like that term because I think that that's really accurate describing what's happening here. You think about what a pioneer is. A pioneer is someone that goes to a territory that's unknown, that no one has been to, that they don't know what to expect, but they're going to go and explore and kind of put themselves out there anyway to be able to move on and settle this new land here. And this man has that kind of faith, I think, the kind of faith that goes beyond where other people have taken it. So far, this really great trust in Jesus and things that he has not seen happen. And there are some other examples of that kind of pioneer faith in the scriptures. In Hebrews chapter 11, there's the really big account of all the different men and women of faith. And when it gets to talk about Abraham, and it talks about Abraham and whenever he's going to offer up Isaac, that he believes that God was even able to raise Isaac from the dead. What was Abraham basing that on, as far as we know? Or what other example of resurrection could Abraham look to strengthen his faith and make him believe that God could actually do that? As far as we know, none. That would have been the very first time that someone was raised from the dead. Actually, in the text, in the scriptures, the first time that we know of someone being raised from the dead isn't until Elijah. So it's a long time after Abraham was alive. But he believed that God could do that thing that no one had seen. That's the kind of faith that we're talking about. Another example is actually in the next chapter, in Luke chapter 8, of the man or of the woman who has the flow of blood in Luke chapter 8 and verse 43 and following. She has this flow of blood for 12 years, and no other doctor could help her to overcome that illness. But she believes, and when you couple this with some of the other Gospels, what she's saying to herself, that she doesn't even have to go and talk to Jesus. She doesn't even have to like get his attention on her. All she has to do is just touch his garment, and then she'll be healed. What else could she base that on? As far as we know, nothing like that had ever happened before. But she believed in the greatness and the power of Jesus to the point that something that no one else had seen could be accomplished by him and through his power, and that happens for her. And Jesus commends her faith as well. In Luke chapter 8, in verse 48, he says, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." And so she has that great faith that goes beyond what other people have seen accomplished. And so that's the kind of faith, I think, that makes Jesus marvel. That's the faith that Jesus says, I haven't seen this kind of faith anywhere else in Israel. Because it's one thing to believe that God and Jesus are able to accomplish something that they've already done and that you've already witnessed and seen. It's another thing to believe that they can accomplish something that you haven't seen or that no one else has seen. And this is the faith in God that I think we need to develop as disciples of Christ. This pioneer kind of faith that trusts that God can do far more abundantly than what our society thinks, what our peers think, or even what other Christians might think sometimes. That we really believe that God is able to accomplish anything. Because he can. He is able to do those things in our lives. And so, as we're wrapping up this morning, I want to just spend the last few minutes briefly considering three different questions about this pioneer faith as it relates to us and developing it in our lives. So the three questions we're going to talk about is first, why is pioneer faith worth having? Why is developing this kind of faith and trusting in that God can do things that no one has seen, why is it worth having that in our lives? If you're trying to persuade me that I need to have pioneer faith, why? So we'll talk about that in just a minute. Then I want to look at what does pioneer faith look like in my life? Like, how do I know that I have pioneer faith? What does that actually translate to practically, having pioneer faith in my life? And then how do I develop that pioneer faith in my life? And there will probably be more answers to those questions than we'll have time or that I have thought to give to answer, but we'll work through them kind of slowly together. So the first question is, why is pioneer faith worth having? Why is it worth being like this guy, to believe that Jesus is able to accomplish things that no one has seen in our lives? And I think what is interesting, looking at this story, and maybe in other places in the scripture, is that having a lesser strength of faith is really not as impressive as this strength of faith that this man has. If this story was just a story that he demonstrates the original kind of faith where he hears what Jesus is able to accomplish and he gets Jesus to come to his house, but he doesn't go further and start to show that he believes that Jesus can do things, that he can heal the servant without even coming under the roof, what makes this story any different from the other healing stories that Jesus accomplishes? Really, there's not that much difference in this man's story and all the other healing stories that Jesus has. Jesus is still on his way to the house. Jesus is still going to heal the servant. But the great difference with this man is that he has this after faith that shows, Jesus, I believe you can just say it, not even be close, and it'll happen. And so what I'm left with, the answer that I'm left with of why this faith is worth having really kind of rests in Jesus' reaction to this man. Jesus marvels at this man, and he really enjoys and takes great pleasure, it looks like, in the faith that this man has. And so one of the reasons why it's so great to have pioneer faith in God is because God likes it, because he enjoys that kind of faith, because he desires us to have the kind of faith and trust in him that goes beyond the things that we've seen or understood or previously heard, but we trust deeply and intimately in him and what he's able to accomplish. It's something that when he sees it, he marvels. And I'll be honest, as I was trying to prepare for this lesson and go through this and look through the text at like what practical reasons are there for having this kind of faith and imitating this man, I wrote that answer down. I wrote down because God likes it. And then I looked back at the chapter and tried to find some more. Like what other practical reasons or personal benefits might there be for me to develop this kind of faith in my life and to encourage others to develop this kind of faith in my life? And I couldn't find anything else really specifically in the story to pull out. Maybe you could if you look deeper at it. But when I started to realize that I was just still looking for more answers than just that one, I started to feel a little bit ashamed that I needed more answers to have that kind of faith, that I needed more reason to have that kind of faith in my life than that God just likes it. That should be enough for us to do something in our life. That should be enough for us to be motivated to be that way or change ourselves in that way, because our King enjoys it, because he likes it. He takes pleasure in that kind of thing. It reminds me of the story in 2 Samuel chapter 23, where David's mighty men are talked about and they're listed. And there's a story in there where David and his mighty men are hiding in a cave. And David kind of is longing for his homeland, for his hometown of Bethlehem, and specifically getting a cup of cold water from the well at Bethlehem, and just talking about how wonderful that would be and how he'd really enjoy it. I don't know. I don't think it doesn't come off as like a command. Whenever I read it, it doesn't look like Jesus is commanding his men to go and get that, or that David is commanding his men to go and get that cup of water for him. But he's just saying, like, I would really enjoy that. That would be a really refreshing thing for me to have. And some of his mighty men, three of his mighty men, hear their king saying that, and that's enough to motivate them to fight their way in and out of a Philistine garrison into Bethlehem, holding a cup of water and bring it back to David so that he can have it. What practical advantage or benefit for those men would they have been able to draw from to influence them or motivate them to go and put themselves in harm's way to do that? There's not really any practical advantage that I can see other than our King would like it. Our King would really enjoy it. And that's what I think we need to come to grips with here, that our King, that Jesus enjoys and marvels at this level of faith. And so we need to have that in our lives to be able to impress him and let him enjoy that. The second question to think about is, what does that look like? What does pioneer faith look like practically in my life? And what I came up with, what I was writing down, maybe you can have some other answers to this, but I summarized it by saying, pioneer faith results in big expectations, grander prayers, and by the world's standards, unrealistic goals. So it results in big expectations, grander prayers, and by the world's standards, unrealistic goals. Sometimes for me, I can get distracted in life by the step-by-step process of life and how, you know, I need to do the next thing on the list and the next thing on the list and the next thing on the list. And so the goal and the end result kind of gets lost in translation for me of like why I'm doing it, what I'm persevering towards, and what I'm ultimately trying to accomplish in the actions in my life. And sometimes I can forget about those goals or maybe even start to feel like those goals are unattainable because they're so far away that I have so much to do before that goal happens that it's just almost impossible for me to get there. And what I think that this pioneer faith illustrates and what it does in our life is that it gets rid of that distraction because we believe that God is able to accomplish those things through our working in this life. And so when it comes to our spiritual walk, our devotion to the Lord, or our perseverance for spiritual or sexual purity, or our evangelism outreach and how we talk with people and what we expect that will accomplish. If our goals match the power of God, then God will be able to do amazing things in our lives. But we need to believe that God is able to accomplish that. And so believing that if I share God's word with people, God's word will change people's lives because he says that it will, and I've seen it happen before. Even whenever I think that it's really unlikely that that specific person might respond to God's word is able to change the lives of people. Or whenever I feel like I'm really beat down by a particular sin and like I don't know how I can overcome this, I don't know how I'm going to be able to get over this in my life, God's power is able to equip me to be able to overcome that. And he's given me different tools to do that, the brethren here or prayer in him or strengthen God's word and strengthen his son. And so I need to have faith that God is stronger than the hard things that I'm facing in my life. And not even just sin, but like difficulties in my life, financial difficulties or job hardships or whatever else, believing that God is capable of helping me to reach the goals that he wants me to reach. And so it'll change our not only our actions, but our outlook on those things, change our mindset of what is actually going to be accomplished. There's a movie that I really like. Some of you have probably seen it. It's called Facing the Giants, where it's kind of a religious style movie, but it's about a football team that's really, really bad. They never win any games, but then they kind of their coach starts to teach the kids that really football is not all that important. What's important is they need to give their lives to God, and then they start winning games. And then it's kind of a ridiculous movie whenever you think about it that way, because that's not how life always works. Just because you turn to God, you start winning championships. But in that movie, there's a line that a really wise man says. There's a kid that starts to kick for the football team and starts wanting to kick field goals, and he's really bad at it. And every single time he goes to kick a field goal, he misses. And he misses wide left, wide right. Doesn't matter how close he is, he can't kick a field goal, which is a relatively simple task to do in football at a certain distance. And his father approaches him and he says, "David, did you think that you were going to miss the field goal before you kicked it?" And he says, "Yeah, I can't do it." And he said, "David, if you expect defeat, then that's exactly what you're going to get. Expect that you're going to make the field goal." And he started to change his mentality and started to get better at kicking field goals. It was amazing what a change in mentality can accomplish. And I think that's really true in our lives as well. That if we expect that nothing good is going to happen, nothing good will happen. But if we expect that God can accomplish good through us because he is so great and powerful and we have that faith in him, even whenever it seems very unlikely, good will happen because God has promised that good will happen to those that love his appearing in Romans chapter 8. And so that's what it'll look like in our lives. It will change our mentality and it'll change our actions, specifically of what we do, and we'll have higher expectations and higher goals because we believe that God's power can match those higher goals and expectations in our life. The last question is, how do I develop that? How do I develop that kind of pioneer faith in my life? And I don't think I have all of the answers. I'm still trying to learn that myself. But one of the things that I noticed with this centurion and in this story is, and there are probably a lot of different other things with this, but one of the specifics with him is that in this story, the centurion wasn't so much impressed with what Jesus could accomplish as much as he was with who Jesus is. And I think that that's an important kind of fundamental difference here. You can see that illustrated a few different ways in the text. In verse 7, he says, "I did not presume for you to come under my roof." That statement has kind of less to do with what Jesus could accomplish and more about who Jesus is. Or in verse 8, where he says, "I too am a man set under authority." He's implying that, I understand what authority is like. I understand what it's like to have people do things that you tell them to do, implying that Jesus is also someone who is set under authority, that has authority over things, and specifically in this situation, authority over the sickness of his slave. And so he can tell the sickness to leave, and it will in that way. But he's having more to do with who Jesus is rather than what Jesus can do. To the centurion, Jesus was more than just the magic trick, or more than just the answer to his problems, or more than just the vending machine that will make his life better, or whatever, that he can just come to and solve all of his issues. But Jesus was a great man that needed to be respected and honored. That's who Jesus was to the centurion. He was more kind of wrapped up in the person of Jesus rather than the abilities or the actions of Jesus. And I know that those two are kind of really integrally connected. But I want to challenge us in developing this kind of faith. And when we're reading the Word of God, and when we're witnessing different things that God can accomplish in our lives, that we would look beyond what he's doing and see who that shows that he is. I think that's what the centurion does here that's really amazing and really bolsters his faith. That it's not so much that Jesus is capable of doing it, but that Jesus is the person that can do it. And that will make all the difference in our lives. We need to not only be impressed with the work of God, but also allow his works to lead us to better know who he is. And the more that we know who he is, the more that we'll trust that he can do things that we don't understand, or that we've never witnessed, or that no one has ever seen in our lives, because we know God is all-powerful, God has made everything, and God is in control. And that will make all the difference in our lives. And so let's set our sights high. Let's set our goals and our expectations high, and our devotion to the Lord, and our commitment to discipline ourselves in the way that the Lord wants us to, and in our outreach and talking with people in the community, set our goals high and equal to the power of God. And consider the love and the power of God that he demonstrates, and then reflect our understanding of his power in our lives and in our prayers and in our actions and interactions with people in the community. And then we'll start to be more like this man. And Jesus will look at that and be impressed. And he'll say, wow, they really have an incredible faith. Not just an ordinary faith, but a really incredible faith that causes him to marvel. I really love that story. I think that that's really helpful, and I hope that that's helpful for you all as well. We all need to constantly be growing and adding to ourselves and adding to our faith in various different ways. And so one of the blessings and ways that we're able to do that is to help each other, to encourage one another and to pray for one another and to study with one another as we all start understanding more and more who God is and what he's capable of doing. And so if you need the help of the church here to do that, there are plenty of opportunities to do that, to pray together, to study together, and to help each other grow. And you can come and make that known this morning, or for the first time. You want to turn your life to the Lord. It's a costly turn. Jesus will talk about that, and we'll get to that later in the Gospel of Luke, but it is a worth it turn. And so it'll cost you a lot, and it'll be hard, but we can help you to do that, and we can help you to do that this morning. So if you need the help of the church here, you can come forward and make your need known while we stand and sing.